I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined on the show today by Henry Lowendorf. Henry has been a peace activist since the 1960s U.S. war on Vietnam. He's a co-chair of the Greater New Haven Peace Council and is a member of the Executive Committee of the U.S. Peace Council and a representative to the World Peace Council, an NGO of the United Nations. The Peace Council is a multiracial, anti-imperialist organization committed to peace, economic and social justice, and to international solidarity with the peoples of the world. In addition to many local and statewide efforts, Henry co-organized a number of recent international conferences. In New York in 2010, calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. In Chicago in 2012, calling for the dissolution of NATO. In Haifa and Ramallah, Israel and the West Bank in 2013, calling for a zone free of WMD in the Middle East. And in 2015, the Peace and Planet Conference and March in New York. He also co-organized the Peace Train that carried Connecticut residents to the massive People's Climate March in September of 2014. He's a co-founder of the People's Energy Action Coalition that emerged from that march. He is a founding member of the New Haven chapter of Jewish Voices for Peace. Henry has a PhD in biology from Case Western Reserve University. In 2007, he retired from his position as associate director of Yale University's Office of Cooperative Research, responsible for handling all the university's inventions, patents, and invention licenses to focus on promoting peace and justice. Henry Lowendorf, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you very much.
Yes, now I understand you recently took seven people to Syria. You're the co-chair of the Greater New Haven Peace Council, and you led seven activists on a U.S. Peace Council-organized peace and fact-finding delegation to Syria at the end of July. And the delegation met with representatives of a variety of organizations, including lawyers, school teachers, hand workers, student unions, university faculty, leaders of industry, Muslims, and Christian leaders, and high-level officials in the Syrian government, including President Bashar al-Assad. So that sounds really interesting. Can you first tell us what motivated you to take this trip and how you go about getting to Syria these days?
What motivated us in the U.S. Peace Council was a paralysis in the peace movement. It's our view, it's our experience, that the peace movement is doing nothing to stop the war on Syria. And I'm deliberate in calling it a war on Syria because it's very clear that the United States has mobilized its allies in Europe and in the Middle East to invade Syria with a whole range of mercenaries. And the goal, and President Obama spelled it out once again, he's spelled it out since 2011, and we can go even further back, spelled out the goal is to overthrow, violently overthrow the government of Syria and replace it, and this is the unsaid goal, but replace it with a client state for the United States, a client that will do the bidding of the United States. So we went because the peace movement has been silent about this. And in some ways, the peace movement is divided. So I can explain more about that, but that's basically when we figured that if we take a delegation of peace activists to Syria and talk to the Syrian people and come back, we will arouse some interest in doing something to try to change the situation where our government, once again, is trying to overthrow a sovereign state.
So I would really be interested to know about how you feel the peace movement is divided around this, because I think that's important. Maybe you could elaborate on that?
So there are major organizations within the peace movement, national organizations, people, organizations that have paid staff and so forth. They're doing nothing. And in part, they're doing nothing because the United States has orchestrated a propaganda campaign that has painted Bashar al-Assad as a brutal dictator. And therefore, he's got to go. The United States has named itself as the prosecutor and the judge, the jury, and the executioner of the president of Syria, and has the ability to tell other countries who their leadership should be, based on the propaganda that says he's a brutal dictator. Our view, which is contrary to that, whatever Assad is, we're neither in a position to defend him or oppose him. We say it is the sovereign right of the people of Syria to decide who their government is.
Right.
And they've got to deal with it in one way or another, but it's up to them. It isn't up to the United States of America. We have, as a peace council, and most of the people in this country who are paying attention, have seen one government after another overthrown by the United States to install a client regime, a real regime that's a client, that does the bidding of the United States, and it's a disaster for the people of that country. Most recently, we've seen what happened in Afghanistan, we've seen what happened in Iraq, in Libya, in Honduras, and on. I can give you lots of countries where this has happened, and it's a disaster.
Right, and anyone who's paying attention knows that. I agree with you. But there are a lot of people in America who don't pay attention and follow the propaganda, so it's good that you did what you did. But continue on the division in the peace movement.
So the division is basically those who buy into that propaganda and are hesitant because they are hesitant to oppose the United States because they bought this propaganda. From our perspective, we look at this and we know the pattern. There's a pattern there. We connect the dots. We say, we know this propaganda. It's in a massive campaign. I mean, all sorts of people, human rights organizations, the media go along with this. But we've seen it again and again and again. And leadership in the peace, the overall peace movement, major organizations in the peace movement in the United States have not taken a stand, have not, there have been no demonstrations of, you know, maybe, I don't know, there was one demonstration in New York. No national action. And the major peace organizations are doing nothing. They're doing nothing, and we're small. The U.S. Peace Council is small. We're trying to do something. We do vigils. We lobby our members of Congress. We do conferences and so forth, but we're small. So we said to ourselves, there's this division. There's a small group of people or a number of people around the country who understand that this is propaganda and don't believe it and say, whatever Assad is, it's not up to us to overthrow his government. The decision about whether he's ruling or someone else runs the government is up to the Syrian people, not up to the U.S. government, which has a bad reputation.
Yes.
In overthrowing other governments. So that's the division. The division is over, yes, the U.S. has the right to do this, and we have to be silent because we may not like it, but it has the right to do this. Or those of us who are speaking out and saying, our responsibility in the peace movement is to stop the war. And since the war was started by and encouraged, induced, it's funded by the Saudis and Qataris largely, but the U.S. is also spending money. But weapons flowing from Libya, flowing from other CIA sources into Syria, through Turkey, through Jordan, and the crazies, the jihadists and other extremists, the U.S. is supporting one way or another. So this is our responsibility. We have to do something. So that was the reason that we said, let's do this.
Now, just one last question on the division in the peace group, and I'll let that go. But do you feel like there's infiltration in the leadership of the peace movement in these larger organizations?
I don't think that's the issue. I think they're very good people who are involved in these large organizations. I don't think there's anyone. They do a lot of good work. But when it comes to, I can give you three examples that are quite obvious. When it came to the bombing of Yugoslavia, the bombing of Serbia, peace movement was split. There were those who said, Milosevic is a brutal dictator, therefore, and basically they are justifying the bombing. They may say, don't bomb, but they're justifying the bombing by playing the game of accepting the propaganda and going after him. So in Serbia, the bombing, the peace movement was split. In Libya, the bombing, the peace movement was split. For the same reason, because the United States had demonized Muammar Gaddafi. And having done that, the peace movement buys into that and says, we don't want to be called Gaddafiists, and we don't want to be called Assadists. And the U.S. Peace Council has been slandered by some of the basically good people by calling us, saying, oh, they consort with unsavory governments. All right? So instead of looking at what we've said and what we've done, they basically projected their own feelings onto us. And I just repeat it. We in the United States have no right to determine a government elsewhere. We have no right to determine the government of Syria or Greece or Britain or Honduras or Venezuela, etc.
Right. It should be up to the people in any country to decide who their leader should be. And, of course, we're violating international law by interfering. Now, I can name a fourth situation where the peace movement was divided, and that comes to 9/11, because I was a lefty and in the peace movement, but when I went into looking into the evidence of 9/11, then I got shunned. So the peace group got divided because a whole bunch of us on the left get that 9/11 is not what we've been told. Also, there's a lot of propaganda and lying around that.
Right.
I know you disagree with me on that somewhat, but I just want to throw that out there, that that's also another division in the peace group.
It is. It is. I think various people on both sides of that issue have reasons for either pursuing it or moving on. I don't want to have a dog in that fight, right? I don't believe the propaganda, but I also feel like there are much more important things to pursue than that, because somehow pulling it out of the graveyard that it's in is really, really hard, as you know, because you've been trying to do it. And I think that at some point, the truth is going to come out, as it has. We know how many years later that the Gulf of Tonkin was a lie that, that Lyndon Johnson promoted. We know so many lies that have come out 50 and 60 and 70 years later. So it's very hard to bring the truth out in this country, as it is, I would guess, in most countries. It's very hard because
the media is controlled by the propagandists.
Controlled by the people who basically control the government. So they have a significant interest in making sure that the people of this country don't know the truth. When the truth does come out, I think people respond.
Right. That's why we work so hard at it, because they couldn't justify all these wars if people knew the truth about 9/11. But anyway, I want to hear about your trip to Syria, because you're unique in doing that. You know, most of the people who listen to this radio station get that the mainstream media lies and it's a lot of propaganda, and even a lot of the alternative media. So they get that. But tell us how what you saw in Syria, how it differed from what we're being told here.
Okay, one of the things, there are two main things that I learned in all of the discussions, and you read off the list of some of the organizations, the people we talked to coming from these different organizations. But there were two main things we learned that practically everybody we spoke to brought up. Not that we asked that question, but they brought it up anyway, because this was on their mind. This was their main concern. And one of them had to do with the fact that the majority of Syrians are in areas that are protected to the extent it can by the government. The majority of people are in the areas protected by the government. But the people that are interviewed in the media in the United States all comes from the areas that are controlled by the mercenaries, which I call terrorists, because I think that's what they are. And the United States, talk about consorting. The United States is consorting with the worst terrorists in the world, starting with Saudi Arabia, but ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all of the mutant names that Al-Qaeda has gone through in order to confuse the population in the United States and in Europe and so forth, to confuse them, because we get all these different names. They all do the same thing. A day or two before we got to Syria, one of the so-called moderate groups, but one of the moderate groups the United States supports, beheaded a 12-year-old Palestinian boy and showed the video and pulled his head off and showed that. That's a moderate group, because they said he was fighting with the government. He was fighting for the government. I don't listen to anything they say and take it as true, but you see the video and they're bragging about it. This is a moderate group. But most of the people in Syria, the people who are refugees in Syria, are largely refugees in the government-protected areas. They fled from the areas that the United States mercenaries control. They have fled from there, or they've left the country. But most of the people still in Syria, and they haven't fled from the government-protected areas to the terrorist-protected or controlled areas. They've fled in the direction toward the government. That tells you something. The other thing that we learned is that the people of Syria have opposition. The government of Syria has opposition. There is a nonviolent opposition. Some of them are in the government, some are out of the government, some are in the parliament, and so forth. There is a nonviolent opposition, and they have their own policies and their own programs that are not the government's programs. But there's really a national unity government right now, because one of the ministers we met is the Minister of Reconciliation, and he is a leader of the main opposition party, but he has joined the government to deal with reconciliation, that is, instead of revenge, reconciliation. And there's a whole story that we've learned about what that entails, and I can go into that. It's very interesting. But I want to stick to the main points at the moment. And the main point is that the Syrians are protected by the government and the Syrian Arab Army, which is the army of Syria. They feel protected by those. And that's why they've stayed or fled to the government-protected area. The only thing between the majority of the people and the terrorists is the government and that army. That's what protects them. That's what prevents the terrorists from taking over. And if the United States is angry at ISIS and says, okay, you behead people, you terrorize people, you kill Christians because they're not Muslims, or you kill Shia because they're not Sunni, or the Sunnis aren't religious enough, et cetera, that you're horrible, we're going to fight you. And the fight is half-hearted because the goal of the United States is not to fight, that's the secondary goal, is not to fight ISIS. The goal is to overthrow the government. And so ISIS, they're very dedicated and vicious fighters. They're good fighters. So that's the first. The first is that the Syrians are united in supporting the government, even in the opposition to the government. Even the real opposition within Syria exists. To call the terrorists and the mercenaries opposition, I think, is a propaganda tool. And there are a lot of the other propaganda tools we could talk about.
And every country has opposition parties that are peaceful, so that's nothing new to have Syria have an opposition party.
If having a government that you don't like, even a brutal government that you don't like, leads to armed opposition, I ask, okay, where's the armed opposition to Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or even the United States, which, to quote or paraphrase Martin Luther King, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Still, since 1967, the United States is still the greatest purveyor of violence. Independent of presidents, right? Independent of Congress, they're consistent in being the greatest purveyor of violence. So if people in this country get to that point where we don't need help from outside. If we get to the point of wanting to overthrow the government, we don't need help from outside. We don't want that. But that's not the way we get rid of our government. We have a process for doing it. As flawed as it is, we have a process for changing government. And we saw some real debate taking place even in this presidential campaign. We saw some non-debate, but we also saw some real debate and real programs that people could get behind. Doesn't always work, as we know. It's not an easy process. But the Syrian people also have a process, and it's up to them to decide. Within the government-protected area, which is the area we were in, most of the people are, they support the government. And once the aggression is over, they're going to end up in political battles, not in violent battles, but political battles, and that's their right. So the second thing we learn, which I think is something that we need to learn in the United States, that is that, and this was said by a number of the people we met, but the two people that come to mind are the Grand Mufti and the Orthodox Bishop Luca, Grand Mufti Hassoun and the Orthodox Bishop. And we met with the Grand Mufti, who we thought was the leader of the Muslims. It made sense to us. But when he talked, he said, I'm not the leader of the Muslims. I'm the Mufti for 23 million Syrians. 23 million is the total population of Syria. I'm the Mufti for everybody. We don't divide ourselves up. We don't accept dividing us up into Sunni and Shia and Alawite and Kurd and Assyrian and whatever. We don't accept that. Christian, Muslim, we don't accept that. We don't accept to be divided up. When we talk to each other, when we work with each other, when we meet with each other, we don't ask, are you Christian, are you Muslim, are you whatever? We want to know, are you Syrian? Yes, that's all. I mean, you are. Maybe you're from Lebanon or you're somewhere else, but we look at you as a Syrian. And the bishop of one of the Orthodox churches agreed completely. He said, yes, he's the mufti of 23 million, and I'm the bishop of 23 million. We want to allow the foreigners to divide us up. And when you think of it, that's exactly what the United States has done, what Britain did to India,
right,
what it did to Palestine, what it's done to so many countries, and the U.S. has done exactly the same thing. Let's divide them up, and then we will conquer them. We did that in so many countries. Iraq is a terrific example. We did it in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. Get people to fight each other, and then we'll take over. And that's what they're trying to do in Syria. So what do we call Assad? He's an Alawite. Most people in this country don't know what that is. There are these branches of Islam, So that's one branch. It's a small branch. The majority, as I understand, the majority of the government, the majority in the parliament, they're not Alawite. They come from the majority, which is Sunni. So you have a propaganda tool that the United States uses to divide the people from each other so that it can overrun the country. And numerous people said that to us, because we don't go around saying, you know, hi, with a badge, I'm Sunni, I'm Shia, I'm Alawite, I'm Christian, whatever. We're Syrian. And I heard that from many, many people. And they're serious about it. But that's a lesson we have to learn, that this artificial division is something that the imperial powers create so they can control another country.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think they do it here domestically also. And,
absolutely.
And that may be what's happening in the peace movement. You know, you don't know. And also, what about the Russian presence in Syria? Are the Syrians, you know, they were asked to be there by Assad. How is that going, and how are the Syrian people, what did they tell you about that?
Well, first of all, let me make a distinction between the Russian presence and the U.S. presence. The Russians were invited in. The Russians have been long allies previous to Russia with the Soviet Union. The Iranians have been long allies of the Syrians. Lebanese have been long allies of the Syrians. And those are the three countries that are working with the Syrian government against these intruders. The U.S. has not been invited in. The U.S. is building air bases. U.S. has boots on the ground, as I say. They have troops on the ground there. The admitted number is in the hundreds.
That's unbelievable. We'd have the gall to build an air base there, totally uninvited.
<It's> I know. It is. So the international law says that the country has the right to ask for allies to defend it. Even the dirty NATO organization says the same thing. You know, if France is invaded, it has the right to call in the other NATO countries to support
right.
it. If Turkey is invaded, it has the right, and these other countries are bound by a treaty to do so. Well, why shouldn't Syria be able to do that? Well, because the United States says it can't, you know, and the United States rules the world. Not. So the first thing I wanted to point out is the United States is there illegally and the Russians are there legally. The second point more directly addresses your question. Until not quite a year, September 30th of 2015, the Syrians, I think, were fighting to a standstill this outside aggression. And let's keep in mind, who was on the side of the aggressors? The United States, the most powerful military force in the world, with the most money and weapons, modern weapons, all this stuff. Europe on the side of the United States. Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Israel throwing missiles into Syria and treating in their hospitals, treating the wounded of the terrorists. Amazing. Working with Saudi Arabia. It's just stunning. So you have this powerful coalition trying to overthrow the government of Syria, but it held out from 2011 through 2015, it held out. Imagine that. This small country held out against these powerful forces. We didn't send 100,000 Marines in. We wanted to do this surreptitiously. Still, huge amounts of money. Weaponry that the CIA sent from Libya after the government of Gaddafi was overthrown. All the stores of weaponry that Gaddafi had. United States CIA takes that and ships it to its allies, the mercenaries in Syria. But how could the Syrian government, how could the Syrian army hold out against this? You don't hold out against this if the people aren't with you. But they did. However, it seemed clear to me that they couldn't do this indefinitely. And I think the Russians saw that. And when Syria said to Russia, we need help, the Russians said, okay, we're in. One of the things that happened, and I think the Syrians are very grateful for that, but one of the things that happened as a result of the Russian involvement is that for the first time, there were consistent attacks against these mercenaries and the terrorists. The United States claimed to be fighting ISIS, but in fact, most of the time it was supporting the terrorists of one group or another because they were the ones who were going to overthrow the government. And the primary goal of the United States was not to fight these extremists, but was to overthrow the government. What was the U.S. strategy? Oh, well, after the government is overthrown, we'll get rid of the extremists. Now, we need a reality check with the sanity of our government, I have to say. I mean, you and I know what happened, and most everybody else knows what happened in Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq. We have chaos, and we have total destruction, and
it's
very difficult conditions.
It's just horrendous. It's just, yeah, I get so angry if I really think about that and
right,
what we've done.
Right.
Yeah,
and that motivated us, too, to go, because we need to do something here. So the Russians came in. One of the first things they did, they started bombing the transportation route between Turkey, which has facilitated the movement of terrorists, Islamists, these extremists, the terrorists, the mercenaries, their movement and the weapons movement and money and logistics into Syria. And the Turks have facilitated the movement out of Syrian oil, stolen Syrian oil, factories that have been stolen from Syrian companies into Turkey. That route, the Russians started to bomb. And there were visuals of these huge caravans of oil tankers taking Syrian oil to Turkey. And what did they do? The Turks refined it and bought it, bought the oil, refined it. But they paid the terrorists, right? They paid the terrorists. Now, the United States could have stopped that. It never did. It never did. In 4.5 years of war, it never stopped it.
I'm sure it was encouraging it, actually.
Well, of course. I agree completely. So the United States is really angry with Russia because it pulled the mask off what U.S. policy was, and it actually started pushing back the terrorists and supporting the Syrian army, which meant that the Syrian army has now made significant gains since not quite a year, since September 30th of last year. Significant gains. The besieged areas are the areas that the terrorists control. And they're really besieged by the terrorists. They're controlled by the terrorists. So Palmyra, this ancient historical archaeological site, which was overtaken by the terrorists, and they destroyed many of these archaeological gems that go back thousands of years. The Russians and the Syrian army drove the terrorists out. And after they did that, even while the Russians were defusing mines and so forth, the Russians brought in one of their symphony orchestras and played a concert to the people of Palmyra. I mean, they televised it. You can see it on YouTube. It's amazing. The orchestra bringing their instruments, bringing their bodies into this area that had recently been liberated by the Russians and the Syrians. When I look at it, the U.S. supported the destruction of Iraqi art and culture going back thousands of years. And,
yeah.
And it supported these terrorists who did the same thing in Syria. It boggles my mind. The art community in the United States ought to be outraged at our government for doing this. One of the things we were told is that we were told that Syria makes every effort to restore these things. They can do that if their pieces are large enough. It's rubble, they can't. And so there's certain archaeological objects that are never going to be restored. But they're still waiting for help from the United Nations. UNESCO, which designates Palmyra World Heritage Site, isn't helping, or wasn't up to the time we were there. And there are other reasons to be critical of the United Nations. So I'm going to get back to your question that had to do with the Russians. So I think the Syrians are grateful for their allies, because without that support, it would have been much more bloody. And the end result, if the people of Syria lost, would make Syria look like Libya and look like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
And
it would make the next target, Iran, all that easier to go
after.
Right. Also, yeah.
That is right, to go after Iran. And Iran is not the final. It's Moscow and it's Beijing.
Right.
That's the final. But
that's
a whole other discussion. So I think there was gratitude. There wasn't a lot of talk about it, but if you asked the question, there was certainly gratitude toward the Russians.
And again, you were just listening to Henry Lowendorf, co-chair of the Greater New Haven Peace Council, discussing his recent fact-finding trip to Syria with a 7-member delegation, which was motivated by a division within the peace movement over U.S. involvement in Syria. Tune in next week to hear the second part of this interview. For more information, go to uspeacecouncil.org. And again, that's uspeacecouncil.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people.